I've seen Blake. I run a company called Respondability. And I've been Ruskington to Ness Sleaford. The main thing that I do is I help people overcome the background core problem that's messing up their life. And even when people have lots and lots of problems and things that hold them back in life, there's usually one central thread going through it. And so when people say, oh, you know, it's going to take a fortnight working with me, I've got this and this and this, I say, well, just listen to that list that you just told me, and let's look at what runs through all of that. And usually it's a, I'm not worth it, or I'm not worthy, or lack of self-love is at the heart of it all. And although I haven't got much time, I'm going to tell you something really dramatic that happened to me last week. I was at an event where there were 60 NLP practitioners on a Master Practitioner course, which I took 4 years ago, and I revisited it. And towards the end of the session, we were going to have breakthrough sessions with each other. And I actually said, please just let me be an observer with this, because if you give me for somebody else to practice on, I've got really nothing to resolve in my life. I'm a pretty well sorted out person. If I did come up with anything, it would be so trivial that, you know, it really wouldn't give them a good example of how to work with somebody and all the processes they need to go to. So they agreed to that. The day before this thing happened, I woke up feeling very enlightened and childlike, and it was just the most wonderful sensation. I'm always happy anyway, so it just added to that. I was nearly unbearable with Trudy, but Trudy likes that, the way I am, so that was fun. So we head to this event, and we sit there, and a guy takes us through guided meditation. And quite frankly, I've never been to a session where somebody else helped you with it, and I really struggled with the idea of meditation because I thought it was about clearing your head. But obviously, if you think a lot, you have to clear your head. And every time I tried it, in fact, it did get us to this sort of hollow space. And I was thinking, oh, this is nice, this calm, hollow space. And then I was thinking of what I could do with it. So that took up all the hollow space about how I could use it in a practical way. So I was thinking, oh, this meditation is not for me. That was a little bit of a thing he did. But then he went, right, we'll do a meditation session. And he rang a singing bowl. And I felt this wave of energy go through me, and it was zigzagging. And if I did the right speed, it did that right through me. And after a few seconds, and he was talking, and I was trying to follow it. And as he was talking, I just felt like I was doing that on the inside. The most weirdest feeling. But it got so vigorous. It wasn't violent, and I wasn't frightened by it. But it seemed to be doing that inside, with that movement. And I couldn't believe I could be doing that on the inside, but not doing it on the outside. So I ended up sort of like moving my head to see what physical felt like compared with on the inside. And I shook, and I shook, and I shook inside. I realised it wasn't on the outside, but as soon as I did that, the body went, oh, well, we could join in with you. And so it was doing that. And this was for 15 minutes, and I knew something was releasing. And because I talk to my unconscious, which is what this is all about, I regularly talk to my unconscious, and I asked it to show me, if it could, what it was releasing. And it wouldn't. And I had the good fortune to have worked with somebody the day before, where they had a poker face, and I couldn't actually find out what affected them. And I just literally put them in a mirror, and this was my unconscious, just thought the idea, I'll just reel this stream of things off, until we hit the one that actually they reacted. And because they were looking in the mirror rather than at me, they actually gave it away. So I reeled it off until I got to a certain thing, and then they reacted to it. So I'm asking my unconscious to tell me what it is, and it won't. So in the end, I reeled through a list of things. And I'd never thought of self-love before. And I got to this, but that had cropped up twice in the previous two things I'd done. It was both self-love. So I thought, I'll try to say self-love. And I went from doing this to doing it like this. And I thought, I hit on it. I've got the right thing. So I'm now going, well, release it, release it. And within 10 seconds of me working out it was about self-love, the leader of this group, and there was 60 of us there, said, right, now we're going to change from hands on legs, and we're going to move them to our heart, and we're going to give ourselves self-love. And I thought, the very thing I need. And I went to move my hands, and they were glued to my legs. There was something I had that was an obstruction to giving myself self-love. Whether it was being told you should never show off, or it was about ego, or you know, we shouldn't love ourselves, we should just love other people, but I was glued to it. It took me 1 minute to get my hands just clear of the legs. And then I spent another minute pulling on whatever it was. Felt like a ton on each hand to get it to my heart. The moment I got it to my heart and got it there, it let go. I cried like a baby for about 5 minutes. And it was such a relief, it was just so wonderful. And what it told me was that there's a point where your unconscious believes that the thing it's given you is protecting you. And I've always bargained with it on behalf of other people. But when it gets to the tipping point of the thing it's given you, like an anxiety, as soon as it gets to the tipping point of realizing that the thing it gave you is more harmful than the thing it thinks is protecting you from, it has no option but to get rid of that program. Right? Because it's there to look after you. And it's looked after you with a program that has probably caused you some harm. But in its reasoning of things, that thing has protected you from something more harmful. So this can be anxiety or pain or whatever. And most of the people I see are helped with anxiety. They've had it for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And I literally help them in one session. And the only reason I can do that is because it's not a build of the things in your life that give you the problem. So I will get people who have been abused, and they've been abused for years and years and years. It's, strangely enough, it's not the years of abuse that have hurt them. It's the very first instance of the abuse that in that moment of terror, they have said to themselves, I never want to feel this way again. I've even had somebody as young as 2 where that happened. They actually wrote a program for themselves at the age of 2 saying, I never want to feel this way again. And he switched all his emotions on. So in that moment of terror, and it's fear or anger or whatever, but it's the first time you've ever been overwhelmed by a feeling in your life, and you can't reconcile it at the thoughtful level. How can you? You can't imagine it. It's almost like a demon's taken you over. So as a child, I mean, how can you actually possibly comprehend what this is? All you know is you never want to feel that way again. And in that moment, with all those chemicals pumping around your system, as being only the age you are at that time, you make this childish decision to run a program that says, I will never feel this way again. And in that moment, the unconscious goes, yes, that's a good thing for you. You never want to feel this way again. I will make sure. You leave it with me. I will make sure you never feel that way again. And it turns into an anxiety. And anxiety I can best describe as this feeling then of hypervigilance. You are now looking for the thing that's going to hurt you. It might not be the same as the one that's just hurt you, but for the rest of your life, you will always have that feeling that something bad is about to go wrong. And because you look for things that are going to go wrong, that's what you'll see. We have to have this internal congruence that actually says I'm right, because you have to believe in whatever's happening that it's true. Because if you're running a program as horrendous as that, you have to keep proving to yourself that it's worth running it. And so as you do this and you spend the rest of your life, years and years and years looking around, you're constantly thinking that if I see this coming next time, I might just be able to avoid it. I might be able to duck in time. I might just get the head out of the way of the blow. And that's anxiety. The great thing is, if you learned it in one time, however many years later, you can now unlearn it in one time. And that's why I deal with people in one session. Because you can take them to the point where they actually understand what caused it. And sometimes it's so trivial, you wouldn't believe it. When you see it as an adult, you take them back there and you show them this thing. They'd have done something. I mean, a guy the other day had done something at the age of 2. He knew it was naughty, but he was just curious at something great. And he waited for the mum to come in and find it, and then the dad to come home and meet him. And just in that moment, he made this program up that turned his emotions up for the rest of the morning. It's horrendous. But the thing is, when you get to here, unless you come to a talk like this, you actually just think that's the way you are. You think that's a natural part of your process. We are born to live in joy and happiness. That is our natural default. Look at any child and you'll see it. Even the most miserable kids will do things and they'll fall out with the kid next to them, they'll cry. Within seconds they're running around happy again and chatting to each other. They just let go of things. And so this is what you need to do, is go back in time and let go of things. And then bring that state to the current thing. So most of our life is about the now that we live in. So if we have the future over there and we have the past here, we only ever live in this now. It's just that when we were in the past, that was now. That was now. We've always lived in the now. And all our futures will be in this now. We only ever live in that now. I read something the other day that was so profound that I think most people would have just missed it. It was just about the way that something ends affects how you believe the whole thing. About the whole thing. So for instance, there's a great example with it. There's a guy who puts on a classical record, Beethoven or something, and it's a beautiful record, and he listens for the whole of 20 minutes, and he's relaxed and peaceful, and he's conducting it in his head and everything else. And he really enjoys those 20 minutes. And it gets to the end of the record, and there's a huge scratch on it. And so he's listening to this beautiful music, and he gets to the end, and he goes, and he says, that has ruined the whole record for him. Well, no, it hasn't. It's ruined his memory of this bit. All this bit of enjoyment, he enjoyed in the moment. At the end of it, suddenly he wipes out that bit there. He remembers this bit as ending it. And I straight away ran away in my head and thought, relationships. You get to the end of a relationship, and if you leave them, you're able to work it out in your head why you did it. And if you work it out in your head how you did it, you actually put it away as a program store that says, I've learned from this, I understand, I have the time with them, they seem really nice people, they still think they're a nice person, but they're not like me, I chose to end it. Therefore, I can tidy that up, put it away, I can file it away under an experience I had, and because it didn't end badly for you, then it doesn't ruin all the time you had together. But the other person suddenly has this person that they love, leaves them, and they go, where the hell did it go wrong? Was it me? Was it them? Have they found somebody else? Was it something I did? How could I have behaved differently? And they can't put it to bed because this loop that runs that we're supposed to learn from can't finish off that relationship, tidy it up the other way. And it will also have the thing that if it ends really badly, like that person runs off or shouts at them or just says, I've never given a damn about you, it wipes out all the good things because the end is bad. Your unconscious has such power. Your conscious has very little power. It has about 8 bits of data it holds. 7 to 9, so I've averaged it at 8. If I read my phone number out to you now, digit at a time, and then carried on talking, you would either remember my phone number and not hear me, or you would actually forget my phone number to listen to me. You can't do both. 8 bits a data fills up very easily. If you're in a traumatic state, or angry, or drunk, or sad, and somebody asks you a sensible question, that is not the time to get a sensible answer. And that's the same as when you invented this program that said, become anxious. You're either very young, or you're so overwhelmed by these chemicals that are flooding around the body, this is not a great time to make a program. So let's talk about the program running in your head. As we're born, the unconscious already has installed everything about running your life. Your heart, your lungs, breathing, pH levels in your stomach, the whole lot. It understands you and how to keep you alive. Its sole purpose then is to keep you alive. Hope that you replicate yourself by breathing, keep the human race going, and to make sure that you live in love and joy. It has a built-in process of avoiding pain and pushing you towards joy and happiness. That's how we should all be. Everybody should be filled with love and joy. But things come along that interfere with that, but that was in the past. Each time you've dealt with it, it has actually brought some learning to you. You know, I need to avoid this, or I can do more of this. Unfortunately, we learn more from pain than we do from happiness. So happiness is a temporary thing we do in the moment. We actually do it, we enjoy it, and we don't particularly remember all the happy times of the life. So if I ask you to go now to something happier, you'd probably go to an event like a child being born, or a wedding, or some ceremony that took place for a day, and because there's a ceremony around it, you remember it. And because there's photos of it, you're reminded of it later on. So you can look back at the photos, it reminds you of the memory. And the way the brain works is you only remember the experience, you've actually changed the experience. So in the moment, you're in the experience each time, but as soon as you step forward from that, you only have the memory of the experience. And the memory of the experience is different from the experience. So the gentleman here that enjoyed his 20 minutes of Beethoven, and then went, it's ruined now, has no memory that he had 20 minutes of actually being in the zone and loving it. He can just remember, he put a record with Monty, and a scratch on the end, and he's talking a bit. Right? So we change these things. So what I help people to do, you cannot change the past, but you can change how you view it. So when you go into the past and you view it as an adult, and you see the thing that that child went through, it may seem trivial as an adult when you go back there, and you might even laugh about it. I've had people say to me, you mean I've screwed my life up for 40 years over that? But at the time, it was incredibly traumatic. And you have, I also get them to imagine themselves at that age, at this height. So an adult is this big. And an adult is all powerful. They tell you what to do and how to do it, and you follow that. The first 5 years of your life, it's actually just learning things that you observe other people doing, and as you observe other people doing it, you copy it. We start to learn to walk and talk and everything else. And in every household, even people, even if you have parents who are not very kind or loving, the only thing they won't criticise is you walking and talking. When you start to walk, and you climb up and you do things and then you fall down with a bump, no parent in the history of the world has ever said, walking is not for you. I wouldn't bother. You're going to be crap at it for the rest of your life. I just wouldn't bother with the walking stuff. Yeah, sit to crawl and you'll be fine. No parent has ever said that to any child. but you will get the criticism about other things that really affect you. I have so many people tell me what a teacher has said to them that is seemingly trivial. I remember myself handing in a piece of work. It was about going to the pictures, and I'd watched the Brothers Grimm. And one of them was called Wilhelm. I can't remember what the other one was called. But I went home and I read the thing about that you go to the pictures and you set a brochure for it. And I practiced writing Wilhelm. I realised it was the German equivalent for William. And I did all that. And when I was asked to write this thing at school, I wrote Wilhelm. I spelled it properly, everything. I was called out in front of the class where the teacher put a big red pen through it and said, "You do not spell William like that." And I said, "I'm really sorry, miss, but that is a German name. And that's the German spelling of it. It does mean William, but I have started pregnant." And then she proceeded to shout at me and do things. I am now 62. I was about 11 when that happened, and it's still annoying me. Okay? So you have to be very careful about what you say to people, because they will take things on. You see, and it's not that she said that. It's about how I felt about that. She didn't know the time and effort I put into getting it right. To her, it was just like William. And obviously then when I explained it, she didn't want to back down. I mean, that was it. But I'm taking no notice. So when we form a rule or a program of how life works, we expect that life program to run as we've designed it. So if we don't understand part of it, for instance, don't hit your brother, and you go, "Why shouldn't I hit my brother?" And they go, "Well, you shouldn't hit anybody." And a day later, your brother does something naughty, and the very person who told you never to hit anybody hits your brother. Now, you have a program that says don't hit anybody. And you know that's right, because somebody in authority who absolutely loves you told that. So this is the rule you're running. But then the rule maker becomes the rule breaker. You cannot cope with that. It doesn't fit into the structure. Because we don't learn, there's always exceptions to the rules. Because if you learn that at an early age, you'd never do anything. Because you'd go, "Well, I have to go by the rules, but I don't have to go by the rules because there's always an exception. I can be the exception." We get the same about pleasing others. If you actually have... Let's talk about a mother that dotes on you and gives you anything. You could bring a picture from school and it's a bright orange mess, and your mum said, "What was that?" And you go, "It's you, mummy." And she goes, "How lovely! You just caught me just right. That's beautiful." Right? And they praise you, and you know that to please mummy doesn't take a lot of doing. You've only just got to turn up and smile, and mum reciprocates. So we learn to please others, and that works. Father comes in from work, and he's a bit grumpy that day, and whatever we do, we will not satisfy Father. Right? He's come in, he's tired, you want to sit on his knee, you don't want to know anything. The issue is that we need to understand how we get love back from other people. So if we learn that virtually anything pleases mummy, but hardly anything pleases dad, we can't compute that. We need to know what happens with anybody, how we please them, and the reaction that we're going to get, so that it's not a surprise. But if we go to dad and dad's really annoyed and he clucks us around the ear, then it's even worse, because how does that fit with this program? The strange thing is, though, we have no desire anymore to please mum, because virtually anything can please mum. We keep trying to please dad. So every time he comes in, we annoy him all the more, and he gets madder and madder every time because he just wants 5 minutes on his own. And we never get to please dad. So it doesn't finish this loop off. By the time we leave home and we've been through the teenage year where we fall out with everybody, and then we decide to move in with somebody, we pick somebody just like dad. Because we want to see how we learn to please those people that can't be pleased easily. Because once we've cracked that, we can finish this loophole. and say, I understand it now. I understand how people are pleased. So we marry somebody like that and we work on them to try and get their acceptance. But we've chosen them so that they will reject us. Because that fits in with our understanding. If they reject me, then that's somebody who loves me. Because my dad loved me, but he rejected me. You can take the example of a child that actually has been brought up in home, in a child's home, and eventually some people turn up and take him away, and they go, we bought you, you come home with us. You're going to be our child now. And he can't understand it, so he goes, do you love me? And they go, yes, of course we love you. Now, he can't compute this. They just met him, and they say they love him. Well, so he can't compute that. He also understands that the very people who loved him, gave birth to him, didn't want him. That's his understanding of it. He's been abandoned by the people who loved him. So he relates abandonment with love. The two things are mutual. Right? Quite wrongly. So people who love you abandon you. So he gets in this new house, and he thinks, well, I'll kick off a bit and see if they really do love me. So he kicks off a bit, and they sit in there and say, you mustn't write on the walls. We do love you. We are a little bit cross, but we're not cross with you, just your behaviour, but we still love you. So he goes, right, if you love me, you abandon me. So he does naughtier and naughtier and naughtier things to the point where he'll even set fire to the house and then go, they'll love me now, dear. And at that point, they'll probably go, well, we do love him, but we can't actually fear for our lives if he's not getting there. So we send him back to the hospital. And this lad goes back there and goes, told you. Right? Because it proves to him what he thinks is there. So all the time we're looking to prove ourselves right. So if you set off from here with anxiety, you look out there and you go, something bad's going to happen today, you will find something bad that happens that day. We get this from Friday the 13th. If you're actually at all superstitions, you then go out of the house because you go, oh, it's Friday the 13th, something bad's going to happen today. So you will be looking for the thing that happens bad that day. Or bad news comes in threes. You get two lots of bad news, you're almost looking forward to the third thing happening. So that closes the loop off. But of course, if something else happens, then you go, oh, that's a new loop of three now. And off you go again, looking for the next two. And if you go, I'm really terrified that my friend Fred will die. Eventually, Fred will die. The only way you'll not see that Fred dies is if you die first. So you spend all your life thinking that Fred's going to die, and when Fred dies, you go, I knew that was going to happen. It's stupid. We actually keep doing all these things. So your unconscious starts off with this set of rules and things of how you work. It then listens to you all the time to find out what you want to install. When you do something new, we all feel that we're doing it consciously, and we say, I'm self-conscious about this. This is the first time I've done it. I am self-conscious. That's because you're doing it with your self-conscious. You're actually, it's the conscious you. And when you're doing something new, you have to think, what have I done like this before? And even in a new day at work, where you know exactly how to type and put papers away and everything else, you still get a little bit edgy about, but it's in a new office and I don't know where the paper's filed and I don't know where the photocopier is and all that sort of thing. But after a week of doing that, you're back to knowing that you know everything. And it goes back to your unconscious again. So, I'll have to watch out for the book. Probably got a lot of time. Anybody got the time now? 25. Okay. So in a moment we're going to do an exercise. Are you alright to do that? It's just going to be a relaxation one. And I'm going to base it on something that I invented this morning. So I will allow my unconscious to just direct me almost wherever it wants to go.
Can I have a question for you?
Absolutely.
You said about being something in the past, obviously,
yes.
Many things try to come down.
Because I deal with the core problems of people, it's a bit like knotting the middle, knocking the middle pin down on tangling bowling, that it might knock all the rest down anyway. So I'm always looking for the core problem. So if you've got a series of things that you think, well, which one was it? If they're all the same, it's the first one. If they're similar or they have the same thread through, which, like I say, is usually like a self-worth, it's always about the first time you felt that particular problem. You always look for that first one. With a core issue, that is the one I would say don't do it on your own. Because you will have this safety barrier there that actually tries to protect it. I'd like to quickly tell you the story of the magnetic shield, because this is the one thing that releases people from that problem. Okay? You might understand it, but it doesn't matter if you don't. Okay? Because this can work on your conscience. So there's a guy walking, it's Delton Times, and the guy's left his shanty town home, and he's walking down the track, and it's a dismal place, quite barren, and he sees this beautiful polished wooden shield at the side of the road. And he's really hard up, and he's sort of like, that's a year's worth of money to lose. Why would anybody place the shield there? And he looks around and he can't see anybody, and he shouts out, and there's nobody about, and he thinks, well, if they've abandoned it. And it seems to have been gently placed there rather than falling off the cart. So he picks up this shield, and he's admiring the handiwork, and it's a beautiful polished wooden shield. And he picks it up, and he's doing all the, I'll be a hero now. You know, rather than how he felt inside, he's like a little hero, and picks the shield, and he's playing with it, and he sets off towards the market. What he doesn't know is there's a guy a few villages away who's a bit of an inventor. And this guy has seen somebody at a fair once with two very large metal magnets and asked people if they could push them together. And nobody could push these magnets together. And the second he saw that, he didn't know anything about that, but he knew that they repelled another metal object. He saw that and thought, if I could build a shield and hung a really strong magnet in it, then it would never hurt the shield. You'd have a beautiful decorative shield. And the sword would never hit it, because as soon as it got near it, it would throw them over backwards, and then you would win every battle. And he's going to promote this as a magic shield. So he covers it in wood so that nobody knows what the secret is. And he spends years and all the money building this thing. His wife and kids leave him because he's like, oh, money building this shield. But he's told everybody what he's doing. It's not long before he realizes that magnets actually attract things. It's only other magnets that are in power. So it's not a great idea to have a magnetic shield. And as he discovers this, he goes, oh, my pride. I've told everybody, I've told them I'm going to be rich. And I'm not going to be now, and everybody's going to think how stupid I am. So he decides to pretend to install it, and he's abandoned it there. So the guy that picks it up, he's walking down the road, he's really happy with himself, he's going to sell this shield at the market, he's going to go home with all these groceries, and the wife and kids are going to be absolutely fantastic, and all will be well in his life. So he picks up the shield, and he walks into the marketplace, and as he just gets into the entrance of the marketplace, he's picked the shield up like that, and there's a big thud, and he thinks, what on earth's that? And he looks around, he's a bit wary, so he looks under the shield, can't see any feet or anything, and he looks over the top of the shield, and in it is stuck a very large dagger. And with this, he now looks around, and he realises he's in danger. He looks around, but he can't see anybody looking at him, and nobody looking angry, and he's puzzled by this. So he keeps the shield up, not knowing what's going to happen. And all of a sudden, another thud. And he looks over the top, there's a pair of scissors stuck in it. And he's now stopped shouting at everybody, get your heads down, there's danger. And he's pulling his shield around everywhere. And he doesn't know if anybody's behind him, and he's spinning around, and he's putting the shield out. And then another thing sticks, another, and another. And he thinks, I have to go back home, I can't stay here. And he walks back off, and he's backing off, and he's shouting at everybody, and they all think he's crazy. And he's shouting, danger, danger, get your heads down, everybody, look, look, danger. And he goes all the way back to his cottage. And the wife says, what have you brought back? And he said, well, I found this shield, I was going to sell it, but I need it now. And she said, so nothing. And he goes, no, well, I'm leaving. And so she leaves him. For 2 days he stays in his cottage with his shield protecting him constantly. Barely sleeps. Absolutely starving now. So he decides he has to go back to the marketplace and get some bread at least. And he walks down the road and he's still looking every direction for this danger to come. And as he gets to the marketplace, the people all go, it's that fool that came the other day. And as they start to gather around, all their daggers and swords leap out the holsters. And all start hitting this thing. And as people come towards him, it gets more and more. And his shield gets heavier and heavier and heavier. And eventually he collapses to the floor. He's exhausted from not eating. He's exhausted from the weight of carrying the shield for several days. And it starts to press down on him as more and more metal runs on it. And eventually it crushes the last breath out of him. And as the last breath leaves his body, he lets go of the shield. I'm actually pleased with all the puzzle points because the brain's sort of working well. Okay. So what I'd like you to do is to take an nice relaxed pose and you can stop filming now. Do that sort of thing. And you can join in. How long have we got now? 20. Okay. So just 5 or 10 minutes. If your legs are crossed, I would suggest you unlock them or cross them and just take as comfortable a stance as you can. This is not going to be a hypnotic trance, this is just going to be a nice, gentle relaxation. Probably best that you close your eyes. And I'm just going to talk. The idea that came to me this morning was that you've seen me dance about from the now to the future to the past. But I just wanted you to visualise as though there is a massive canvas on the wall. And it represents your life. And on the left-hand side of it is your life to date. And on there are the significant things in chronological order from when you were born right until now. And where now is, there's just a thin black line there. That's the now of you being sat here today with me. Bearing in mind there's only ever been nows, I want you to accept that you are where you are now. Even if you think you should have been wealthy by now, or you should have been happier by now, or you should have been in a better house, I want you to accept that you are where you are now, because if you don't accept where you are now, you're actually set off from the wrong place. So even if you've got an illness or whatever, I want you to accept that you have that illness. I don't want you to like it. You don't have to like it or love it. I just want you to accept that you have everything that you have now so far, and that you are the end result of every single decision you've made in your life. Your whole personality is based on all the learning that you take so far forward, that your unconscious mind runs for you. I would like you to thank your unconscious. Just get in touch with it and say, thank you for looking after my body, my heart, my lungs, everything you've ever done for me. And I'd like to apologize to you, unconscious, if I've ever blamed you for anything, like the voices in my head or the negative thoughts and feelings. Because those voices in your head are not yours. The only voices in your head is when you're debating something with yourself, because you're consciously reacting to things that you're trying to work out. Any other voice in your head, or the negative voice, is not yours. It will come from one of those programs of somebody what's telling you you're not good enough, or you never amount to anything, or you're stupid, or you're clumsy, or you're overweight, or whatever. So that voice in your head is just a program that's running. Your unconscious can only run the programs you've installed, or the ones you give it permission for. It cannot run anything other than that. Now, I'd like you to take him to a place and actually understand that very few people on the planet understand this, but you can give your unconscious mind that permission in this moment now to be as creative as it wants to be, as long as it's in your best interest. And I would like your unconscious to just give you a nod of the head or something, to just acknowledge that you're talking to it, and just show you that it exists. So just ask for a yes from your unconscious in any way, shape or form. Nod of the head or moving the finger. Something that you know comes from your unconscious rather than you're doing it. Something that's got a bit of movement there so you understand that it's actually coming from your unconscious and that it's not about you. Okay. When you feel that, you actually know you're in touch with your unconscious. If you don't get that, I'll come see me on the stand and I'll take you through a method where you can get that. But just understand that your unconscious has never ever done you any harm other than when it gives you pain to get something mended. So if you break your arm, it will give you a massive amount of pain. And the idea of that massive amount of pain is that's all you can think about. And as soon as you get it mended, so as soon as you put a plaster on a broken arm, it stops being painful, but it's still broken. Okay, so as soon as you've done something about it, the unconscious won't need to keep giving you that message. With this method, you can turn on pain by simply talking to your body, understanding it, and saying, do I need this pain anymore? I've had it for 20 years. If you turned it off, would it do me any harm at all? And you can just keep asking for yeses from your unconscious until it gets to a tipping point where it realizes the thing you want to get rid of is harming you more than the good it does. The second it gets to that point, it has to let go of it. So that's a way you can use direct clearing of past programs. So I'm now going to take you forward to the future. So you have this massive canvas. The right hand side of it is white. It is blank. You can paint anything you want onto it. Because this is the future. And this is where you're going to head to. But you'll still live each day now. Because that black line on the canvas is going to keep moving to the right. But look at the left-hand side of it and look at the colours and the hues of it. And for those of you who are not very visual, imagine that there's a sensory touch to it. Anywhere on that canvas you can touch, you can feel the feeling that corresponds with that. Imagine it's auditory and that you can go and press on any one day in your past and it will tell you everything about it. Imagine that you can go back in the past and even for things that you think were horrendous, you can actually look at it in a different way. You can even go back there as the other person that was involved and see it how they saw it. See it through different eyes. So you can go back any point in the past and you can clear up anything you still believe in that harms you. Because once you don't believe it anymore, it can no longer harm you. So that's about clearing your past up with this method. When we look at the future, you have a white canvas there. Now, you can continue with painting in the same way that it's always been painted. But if you don't like the painting on the left-hand side, clean your brushes. Get the paint out of the colour that you want and dab it all over the future. Paint your own future. To get here today, you had to have that past. That past has made you exactly what you are. And even all the hardships in it have made you a better, more compassionate person for other people that suffer. So even thank your unconscious for all the hardships you have, because that has made you the wonderful person you are today. But now take those brushes, wash them out thoroughly. You can continue painting the left-hand side and put it over to the right, or you can change everything on that right-hand side, because that is a blank canvas. you have all the colours in front of you, you have the clean brush, you can do exactly what you want. You can also do this thing of going back to any part of that picture, and instead of the frame that's over the whole canvas, including the future, you can make that frame smaller, and you can fit it over any section of that picture that's already happened, and just see a small section of it. Pick the happy and joyous sections of it and just cut a frame around it, and then that is something we'd want to put on your wall at home. Just take that picture and carry that forward for you, that lovely feeling that you had once. If you're continually going back and putting that frame around something that really hurts you, then deal with that, because somewhere there in that loop you haven't finished with it yet. You haven't learned your lesson from it. And I'll give a great example. The person I mentioned earlier about pleasing the father. You can finish that loop off by just thinking that sometimes people are just unsatisfiable. That is their problem, not your problem. You don't have to keep everybody else happy. And my example of going to the monastery and having not dealt with self-love myself, I give love out to everybody else, and I hadn't realised that I didn't give myself self-love. Now I have self-love, I have far more to give away. It doesn't stop me giving it away to other people. I have more resources in there to give that love to everybody else. So I want you to look at the right-hand side, and I want you to paint a loving and joyful picture for the future. And just understand that's your default mode. That's the mode you were born in. It's just the other stuff that's going away. So paint that beautiful, loving, joyful picture. Hold that in your heart and your head wherever you go. And you will not only change yourself, you change everybody you come into contact with. It's contagious. If you smile, other people smile, they smile at other people, and it continues from right around the world. Just this few people in this room today that now understand this can change the whole of the world. So I'd like to come back to the present time. Just count back. Count to five. One. Feels good about oneself. Two. Good to be true. Three. From all that old rubbish. Four, we're all jolly good fellows. Five, come on. Okay. Any quick questions before anybody bursts in?
How do you develop self-love?
You develop self-love by, first of all, going back to the core problem and remove the thing that's holding you back from it. There's a period of time that I deal with people between usually about 2 to 5.5 hours. At some point in that time, sometimes I've got so good at it now that sometimes I'm moving them towards it all the time, they're with me, so when it comes, it's not that aha moment. But when I first did it, it always used to be, I was just finding out, just finding out, just finding out, and then there'd be the aha moment, where they would change. As soon as you cut the link to that rubbish that's holding you back, it's like an elastic band that keeps pulling you back there. As soon as you do that, you can step forward into the new you. You won't have developed like your confidence and things like that. So if you've got an anxiety that's held you back, it's held you back from being confident and everything else. So as soon as you let go of that, you can then start to build the confidence, build the muscle of it. We've all got an understanding of confidence, however much we think we haven't, because there's certain things in life you aren't confident about. So it's about just taking that thing and building that confidence up. Just building that confidence up gradually. The only issue I have with clients is because I deal with them in one session, they all change when they go away, but the only thing they do is they worry that they might get the anxiety back. So they're actually worried about the worry, rather than actually having a problem still. Because they don't know anything that other than looking around going, what's going to happen? So when they're released from that, there's just a feeling. So they don't know what the feeling is. Before it used to be fear, but now there isn't anything else. So before I just used to take the thing off the person, but now I fill them up with love and joy. So when I enter the neural pathway of anxiety, to me, it's made it into like a neural motorway. So virtually everything they take on board, instead of making a new little neural pathway and it starts off, I think it nips down the anxiety highway for a bit. It goes, I'm going to have a shortcut here. And so anything you learn has anxiety included in it. As soon as you close down the anxiety motorway and actually then open it up with love and joy, anything new you learn will pass down the love and joy highway that you've just built.
And you're saying that you go through that whole process, you can come out and be okay. Except you
Actual physical pain you can turn off. I might have done it with a lady today that came on the stand with us earlier. But I went to the shop the other day and the woman said, oh, I'm really sorry, I have to sit down, I get pain. And I said, how long have you had it? She was about 45. Since I was 16. I said, what happened? Fell off the horse, tore muscles, did this and the other. I said, is there anything you can now do about it? No. I said, okay. I'm going to talk to your unconscious. So I talked to the unconscious and said, look, this is old pain. Does she need it anymore? I don't know. And I said, just think about this. If you have pain in your spine really badly, if you then got a tumour that tried to give you pain to say, you've got this new problem now, you need to get this tumour sorted, you would miss it because of the old pain that's doing you no good at all. So once I got into the unconscious that actually getting rid of the pain was better than what it protected from, it turned it off.
How much would you like?
If anybody's got pain here, literally come see me on the stand. And it takes 5 minutes, and it'll either turn it off or it won't.
Well, I'll test it.
But I've done the lady today, and I think she was a bit sort of, well, I don't think this will work. But she didn't even have the ability to be free of pain to stand up to check it out. And so it was like, so I just left her sat down and did it with sat down. But usually I do it with people stood up, and you still balance procedure with it that actually taps you into it. But you can do virtually anything with this. And what you've got today is the future bit that I've never done with anybody. I know Alan here does like journey work and does do future work with people. But I've never done that before. That just came from my unconscious this morning. I just let it have free reign and it just produced that as soon as I woke up. And I didn't do a lot of work on it because I wanted it to be fresh. Because quite often, truly my partner, when she asks me something, I'll start talking it through. I actually develop a technique while I'm talking because it might even be something I don't know about. But all you're doing is you're tapping to all everything you already know. As soon as you understand how your unconscious works, you can tap into it and use it for anything. So soon you'll see a book on the shelves called Brain Bargaining by Stephen Blake. I suggest you buy it. It's got about 13 different ways the brain works. In fact, there's a 14 now, because I actually thought of one last night. And as soon as you understand how your unconscious works, then you can talk to get it to do things for you. It really is that simple. So, I've been seeing Blake, you've been a fantastic audience. Thank you very much.